accession number 13281, reel 4.
Said Scroggy, reel 4. Whilst you were in Italy, how much contact did you have with the local civilians?
A great deal. You could have as little as you liked or as much as you liked. My interest in them was to speak the language with them, even though there was the barrier of the local patois, etc., and just to find out about their way of life. I was fascinated by their practice. All the peasant houses were the same, and they all baked their bread in the forno, or external oven, on a Friday. And they all made their bread in the same way. They got a plank, and they put it in front of the fire, and they rolled out the pasta, and they made it into... or the dough, and laid it in lumps on the cloth and ruckled up the cloth between each loaf and put it into the oven, and there it was. And they all had the same way of making the tagliatelle, cutting it into long strips and boiling it in the pentola, or big pot. And, of course, if you gave them a tin of bully beef, they would give you as much tagliatelle as you wanted. Bully beef and fags were currency, weren't they? No, I loved the Italian peasants, and they were so colossally resilient. The war machine had rolled over them. They lost everything, because what the Germans couldn't take, they destroyed. They would machine gun the wine butts and slaughter the oxen, and they left nothing for the Eighth Army. It was the constant cry of the Italian peasants, the Germans have stolen everything, hanno rubato tutto. And they went on the long list, the Galeni, the Miali, the Bue, all the animals that had been pinched, and all the rest of it. Mind you, when the Eighth Army arrived, they weren't above pinching stuff from the Italians as well. Although, in the B echelon of the Eighth Army came along a lot of characters who were prepared to help themselves to anything that the Germans hadn't taken. Well, it's hardly conceivable that that wouldn't happen. I remember the boys, we were billeted round about, or in position round about this Italian farmhouse, and the boys invited me up to a loft above the... And I knew they'd pinched this hen, and I knew they'd cooked it, and I knew they were getting me in on eating it in order to incriminate me as well. But that was c'est la guerre. What? I just enjoyed the chicken. It was dead, after all, so we might as well eat it. That kind of thing. And I remember an interesting thing, not connected with the Italians, but connected with the Eighth Army News, the official Eighth Army paper, which had a marvelously entertaining cartoonist called John, collections of whose work must be available, I suppose. They involved the two types, the two Eighth Army lads, the tank man and the gunner officer, in their extravagant, bizarre dress. There was a little item, I remember, reading out to the boys. I said, here, listen to this. The item said, the Allies have developed a weapon so terrifying in its potential that they're not going to try it out against the Germans, they're going to try it out against the Japs. Now this was 6 months before Hiroshima. And there was this little paragraph. And I remember we discussed what it could be. We had no idea that it was to do with split atoms. Everybody said it must be some kind of death ray. Like the so-called ray early in the war, these various pylons kept being put up here and there. Actually, they were connected in this country with radiolocation, weren't they? The ancestor of radar.
Yes.
Right. Ah, but in the country, they had a much different explanation for these things. They said these emit rays that cause the engines of German aircraft to cut out and then they crash. Look at this that happened the other day. So-and-so was going along the road in his car when the engine suddenly cut out, and then an army officer came out from the hedge and said, did your engine cut out just now? Yes, right. You'll find you're able to go on now. These were the stories that were going around. One, a ray. However, we had no idea of the atomic bomb. But there it was, foreshadowed in that little paragraph in the... I was terribly sorry for the Italians, because they were so wretched and they'd got so little, and we were able in a minor way to help them with a bit of grub and fags and stuff like that. Anything was better than the German occupation anyway. a pal of mine, Dallas Allardyce, was taken with the commandos in North Africa and put in prison in Italy under the Germans. And during the Schlimmzel, when Italy changed sides, a lot of the boys escaped, including Dallas Allardyce and a guy called John Mackay, now a hotelier in Blair Athol. And they literally hid up for a year behind the Italian lines. And they were in touch with the local partigiani. And the partigiani kept them supplied with grub. And some of the better items of grub, chocolate fags and whatnot, they pinched from supplies of that kind of thing going to the Austrian major who was in charge of that district. Well, after the war, Dallas and John Mackay went away back to Italy to meet the people who had been so good to them during their period behind the lines and to look up the old cave they'd lived in and stuff and recall the old days. And who was visiting the village but the Austrian major? Because he'd been such a popular guy. His rule had been so light, you know. He said to the people, look, I'm in the German army and all the rest of it, but I'm as much a prisoner of the Germans as you are. You toe the line and play ball with me and I'll play ball with you. And he was a terribly popular guy. And he was being feted by the Italian villagers.
Where was this?
Some little village, Tuscany, perhaps. But I can't be sure where. Dallas would know. And he doesn't live terribly far away from here. He went on to play scrum half for Scotland against the All Blacks. However, that was why. Oh, a very interesting thing. We mentioned Italy changing sides during the war. And you may remember that Mussolini, when the German, the grey-clad myrmidons poured down through the Alps to steady up the situation, Mussolini took refuge in a mountain hotel. Now, that mountain hotel was on the high plateau of Gran Sasso d'Italia, and that is where the scouts were pulled out of the line to go and practice their skiing. Now, there was a carrello on cables took you from the bottom right up to the top, and then you could zigzag your way down about 5,000 or 6,000 feet on the snow. On top of the chair lift carrello thing was this hotel, and sticking out of the snow were the bones of the German gliders that had landed from that force. What was he called? Scorzini. The German,
yes.
The German, as you were, commando bloke, and he pulled off a brilliant raid and put a snatch on Mussolini and got him off the top of that hill. Well, we saw the remains of it, as it were, just when we were playing around on our skis and in that area. Terminillo was a neighbouring hill, and a tragedy occurred on Terminillo. Tom Peacock was a great English climber who kind of attached himself to the scouts latterly after our Canadian experience. And he was down there laying on things for this skiing practice of ours on Terminillo. And he was leading 4 or 5 Lovett scouts underneath this crag on Terminillo. They were on skis when an avalanche came down and buried the lot of them. By Jove, Tom Peacock was lucky. He got out, but the others lost their lives in that avalanche. And they tell me that when they dug them out, such was the weight of snow on them that they were pretty well two-dimensional. Huh? And that was the end of 5 scouts. I didn't know any of them personally, but that was a nasty thing that happened.
What, after all your experiences, are your feelings today about war? Still the same as they were?
I'm all in favour of a good, honest, limited warfare. Mind you, weapons are so damnably accurate nowadays that it's taking some of the chance out of warfare, isn't it? In the good old days when people flung stones at each other, you could dodge them. In the Second World War, for all the millions and millions of rounds of bullets and shells and bombs, how many ever actually did any damage? Very few. The kind of warfare that I knew in Italy, this skirmishing business on a small scale, it's kind of like a sport, really. For instance, if you ask me, was I in favour of the Falkland Islands, do I say 100%? The Falkland Islands, it's not so much that they were British. It is simply that the Falkland Islanders wanted to be British, not Argentinians. And that was enough for me. And I really think the campaign fought by Britain, both naval, air and ground, was perhaps one of the most brilliant operations ever conducted by British arms. And I have a kind of a vague feeling it might almost be the last one. The last and greatest. The infantry action, battalion action at Goose Green was just stupendously successful. And it wasn't against a lot of greenhorns. There were really hard marine troops there. And yet somehow or another, by force, by deception, by a combination of the two, H's plan worked, and they rounded up all those prisoners. What? By goodness, if the Germans had held the Falklands, or if the Poles had held Falklands, or the Jews, we'd never have taken them. I don't think so. But it was a wonderful, I'm really proud of the victory in the Falklands War.
Now, I think that you had some experience of the bombing of Aberdeen. Can you tell me when and how it happened?
I did, in fact. I suppose the closest I ever was to the war, and this includes being in Italy, was when I came out of the ice rink one evening in Aberdeen. I think it was in 1942, spring, and I noticed that the air raid warden at the end of the street had got on his tin hat. I said, "What do you got your tin hat on for?" He said, "There's a purple warning on." Meant German aircraft were imminent. Paid no attention to that. Got onto a tram car which began to go up Great Northern Road, and I was on top of the tram car at the very front when I suddenly saw flying down towards me at rooftop level, easily identifiable, three Heinkel 111s with red tracer bullets coming out of the machine guns and raking the streets, so the tram stopped. I got off the tram, and I just in the position where one foot was on the cobblestones and one hand was holding the stanchion when I heard a whistle, and I didn't stop to ask what it was. I dived under the tram car, got up, and the entire tenement just beside me had slid into loose stones and mortar and rubble and rubbish, everything gone. So I thought I'd better get back to the camp, which would be about a couple of miles away, Hayton Camp, and reorganizing rescue squads and whatnot. So I started walking up the street, dodging bombs which kept going off. The daylight was beginning to go by this time, and occasionally there would be the patter, 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 which were incendiary bombs coming down and lying sputtering in the street. And as the darkness went, the glare of the flames, you would think the whole of Aberdeen. And there were the bombs going off, and there was the ACAC going off. And eventually such a cloud of incendiary bombs began to come down that I took refuge in what we call a close in Scotland. And I shut the door, and there was an old woman inside there, trembling, so I held her hand and comforted her. And a bomb came down and blew the door off the close. And then at the same time, someone from the other side of the street came staggering across, saying, "What we need here are men." I thought he was drunk. However, I followed him across, and in the glare of the flames, I saw that an air raid shelter had been struck at the end by a bomb, and it was pretty much of a shambles and half-buried people and lying there, and one chap, obviously shocked, buried right up to his chest and plucking at the air and muttering in an incoherent manner. So I made my way up to the camp, but by that time things had been organized, and there was nothing really very much for me to do. But it really was a quite apocalyptic scene. And really, the tram cars abandoned and smashed, and wires all over the road, broken glass everywhere. The soles were pretty well out of my boots by the time I got back to the camp with walking on broken glass. And it was really quite a night. I think it was the sharpest air raid that Aberdeen ever experienced. I suppose they could have been aiming for Hull and Russell, the shipyard, or it may just have been a piece of Luftwaffe malignity. I don't know. But well over 70 people got killed that night, and hundreds were badly injured. And as I say, that was really the sharpest experience of warfare that I had, perhaps, during the whole war.
Which street in Aberdeen were you in?
In the Great Northern Road. George Street leaves Union Street, and the Great Northern Road, and if you push up that, eventually you're heading in the general direction of Dyce and places like that. And we were encamped in what had been a football field and was now covered with mouldering old shacks and sandbags. It was a somewhat squalid army camp. And that's where we were. I was with the Cameronians at this time. Curious enough, later on, when the Lovett Scouts came back from the Rocky Mountain experience, we finished up in Hayton Camp with the Lovett Scouts, and it was from there that we marched down Berry Den Road to Joint Station Aberdeen to get on the train, to go to the tail of the bank, to get on the boat, to join the convoy, to go to Italy. However, that raises the question of why the scouts got there to Hayton Camp and where they'd come from. And this relates to the 5 months that the unit did in the Rocky Mountains. We had been in Wales practicing rock climbing and things like that. And then we got on the Mauritania in December 1943 at Liverpool Docks, 700 of us. Apart from us, the ship was empty. It was a 35,000 tonner, of course, the old Mauritania, and it could go fast. It didn't have to go in convoy. So we took a great sweep across the Atlantic, away south, and it took us 8 days. We had no idea where we were going exactly. And I woke up one morning and just found that the ship wasn't swaying and rocking. We were obviously in enclosed waters. I went up on deck and a freezing blast of cold air came off a coastline, and there was snow on either side of us as we were going up a river estuary. I very soon identified the Hudson River, and what a wonderful spectacle it was, after 3 years of the blackout, to see a city which was in effect lit up. They called it the dim out in the States. They were saving electricity, but the skyscrapers on Manhattan Island were an absolutely wonderful sight. And there was an American beside me on deck, a middle-aged American, and as a certain well-known statue drifted past on our port bow, he said with obvious emotion, "There she goes, old Lady Liberty." It was the Statue of Liberty. We got off the boat, we got onto buses later that day, went through New York at 40 miles an hour, entrained in Grand Central Station, and 5 days later, we got out of the train in Jasper, Alberta, in the Rocky Mountains, 3,000 feet above sea level, temperature 20 degrees below zero, and 700 Lovett Scouts got out of that train. They formed up with the pipers in front of each squadron, and we had a 3.5 mile march in 4 inches of snow, lovely squeaky powder snow. When the snow is really cold, it makes a lovely squeak when you walk on it. Now, I made friends with Jasper folks called Taylor. They subsequently told me that one of the most moving experiences of their life, they had been tucked away far from the war. They didn't know anything about the war in Jasper, Alberta. And suddenly the war seems to have moved in the person of these 700 Lovett Scouts with their bonnets on and the pipers in front. And they have described that moment when these lads marched through the village as one of the most moving. They brought a lump to their throat to see it somehow or another. And that 5 months when the scouts were there in Jasper is the greatest thing that ever happened in Jasper, and they still talk about it to this day, and people write papers about it. Anyway, we had 5 or 6 months there, winter of 43-44. We developed various training areas, watched our snowball, Tonquin Valley, Columbia ice fields, anything between 3,000 feet above sea level and 7,000 feet above sea level. We were never off skis the whole time. The snow was so deep and so hard, so soft, because there was never any thawing going on, that your skis sank into it 12 inches. And you were carrying probably up to 60 or 70 pounds in your pack wherever you went. We did various interesting things. Some of the boys skied all the way from Jasper to Banff, 120 miles away. Others climbed various hills or crossed various high ice fields, always in a military manner and always with the rifle and the 50 rounds of ammunition. I personally got a very nice job to do, to climb what is the second highest mountain in the Canadian Rockies, Mount Columbia, 12,294 feet. I planned it for a 3-day operation, 2 nights in snow holes at 10,000 feet on the glacier, and the middle day cut steps for 1,000 feet with ice axes up onto the top of the mountain, back down again. We went up the Athabasca Glacier, had our 2 nights in snow holes, climbed the hill. That was 12 Troop the Lovett Scouts. There would be about 30 of them, and it was my responsibility to get the boys up and to get the boys down again. Glorious weather, about 40 degrees of frost and the full moon when we had our first night in the snow holes on top, and a marvellous view of the serried ranks of the Rocky Mountains going off into infinity in the light of the moon. We climbed the hill, the wind was starting to blow, but it was again a fine day. But when we woke up in the second morning in the snow holes, dense mist. Now, completely featureless country, no life of any description, vegetable, animal or insect, nothing, just us on the glacier, dense mist, and we had to aim for the head of the Saskatchewan Glacier, which is one of the glaciers that emanate like the spokes of a wheel from the central ice field. Well, I had the correct compass bearing, but it was something that you had to be very careful about. I got one of the boys to go out ahead of us and adjusted him until he was on the correct compass bearing, and then we all skied up on him. Ropes together in threes for fear of crevasses. Then I got another bloke to go ahead, got him on the right bearing, and we all skied up on him. And this went on hour after hour until eventually we began to feel our skis running away with us under our feet. We came out under the mist, and I was glad to notice we were halfway down the Saskatchewan Glacier. We had made it. That was one of the greatest experiences of my life. All the boys, most of them Highlanders, who were on this Rocky Mountain thing, look back on it as a kind of a golden age. We were living on the fat of the land, smoked salmon for breakfast, something like 6,000 calories of worth of food per day. Worked terrifically hard. We were enormously fit. None of us could ever have possibly been fitter before, none of us were ever as fit later on. And it was quiet and peaceful. There was no war going on, no thought of it. And that was, in a nutshell, the Rocky Mountain experience.
You weren't in the bombing, coming back to bombing, you weren't in the bombing of Dundee, but you were telling me earlier on the record that you know something about one bomb's set of bombs that dropped.
The odd bomb did drop around. In fact, my wife Margaret, who was born across the road here, swore when she woke up one morning that she'd had a bomb go off, and nobody believed her, but by Jove, two fields away they discovered the crater, so she was right after all. She was a girl at the time. Dundee itself never got a bomb dropped in anger on it, except on one occasion. There was a stray Luftwaffe bloke up there somewhere, and some idiot switched on a searchlight down in what we call the Kump in Dundee, the flat area near the Tay. And I think the Luftwaffe pilot just pressed the button and let go a stick of 8 bombs, which dropped in a straight line across the city. One of them totally destroyed the house of Mr. Moody, the minister, in Briarwood Terrace, West Park Road, Dundee, the house opposite my Uncle Alec Layton and Aunt Anne. The minister was out at the time. His housekeeper was killed, and by jingo, they were picking up keys off his piano half a mile away. But I don't think anybody else was killed. I think she was the only fatal casualty.
Which year might that have been?
42-ish. Probably 42.